What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
America Trends, back with you, and thank you for coming back to us. Larry Rifkin along with John Kropczyk, and you may wonder, what's on the menu today? What are we looking at going forward? And if you are working in a management group, John, in just about any company in America, you've really got to be preparing for a lot of disruption. Now, that disruption may come in various forms. For example, you may find that, you're going to be swallowed up by a new online company that didn't have a name or a logo a year ago.
Well,
but today,
which is a lot of companies want. I mean, they're looking to be eaten up. So that is one way around.
Well, I guess it can be a good thing. But if you've been in business for a long time and oops, you just didn't see it coming. And there's that small little startup company that just came up with a better way of doing whatever you've been doing for the last 30 years. And you're kind of bought in to all your processes and all of your technology, and all of a sudden they sweep you away. Now, the example of that we talk about often is Kodak.
Yes. They love their film.
They love their chemicals. They love their engineers. Everybody kind of hanging around Rochester, New York, thinking, hey, we're the cat's pajamas.
They made some great film, too.
No, they did. They didn't realize. Nobody cares about your film. They just want their images right. And their memories. Right. And if my phone can give it to me.
And you can get it instantly. You don't have to worry or wait to get it
developed
and everything. Because that was always torture for me.
You know, well, now you can.
Pictures, right,
yeah, you can just take pictures
and then you
forever.
Can edit it on the fly.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, let's think about another one. I was thinking the other day about TomTom. You know, when TomTom came out and the others, Garmin, that was the greatest thing, that GPS.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden, I mean, within about 2 or 3 years, who needs a separate device when GPS was being built into your car or was being built into your phone? Who needs them?
I do.
You still have a TomTom?
I still use my TomTom.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, it's an older car.
I do. Well, yeah, well, I do. Plus, I don't know. I find it, the phone is, it's just clunkier, I thought, to use with my smartphone. So I can use this device that gets me there.
Okay.
No problem.
All right.
My phone is still a phone.
But do you upgrade the software? Is it even available to you? Or?
Yeah. No. It's a newer unit.
Unit. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, it's still there. But let's put it this way, John. It's been superseded by new technology.
I mean,
there are just so many things that we can't even keep up. It's almost dizzying now when you think about it. So we are going to be talking about a book that tries to help companies and individuals, and if you're somebody who's in some kind of corporate structure or a small business for that matter, Mastering Catastrophic Risk, How Companies Are Coping with Disruption. Now, it's not only disruption from other competitors, John. I mean, you can find yourself in difficult circumstances because of climate change and weather, that really takes your business out. But you have to look at all the near misses and all the things that could befall you if you're not alert and awake to all that's going on in your environment. It could be regulatory changes or taxes. I mean, companies really have to be on their toes. They really do.
I think bigger companies, too, have a tougher time with change. I think change doesn't come easy, where these smaller companies are, you know, a lot better at it because there's less people, there's less, you know, to do. So I think that's a problem with big companies.
And don't forget, what is a big company today? I mean, we used to have big companies that had lots of plants and machinery. And now, in many cases, some of the biggest companies we have just have distribution centers, warehouses.
Or just have software.
Or like software Uber. And brands. Right, exactly. So it's a different world. It's a changing world. And it's one that we wanted to explore in terms of helping you to navigate the various risks that clearly are out there for all of us. And I think we've got a great scholar to help us through this. Again, the topic, Mastering Catastrophic Risk, today on America Trends.
On the line with us on America Trends, the book, Mastering Catastrophic Risk, How Companies Are Coping with Disruption, and the author, Howard Kunreuther, and his partner, of course, is Michael Useem, but Howard is with us today. Howard, I've got to ask you, we had someone on recently who had written a book called On the Verge about predictive analytics, suggesting to us that, well, with all of the algorithms and all of the data available to us, there should be very little that surprises us. But is that really the case?
Well, I think it is certainly true that we have the ability to be able to look into the future and say, what's the likelihood of certain events occurring? But when we start talking about these very low probability events, there are two things that happen. One is it's harder to have to say anything with complete confidence. You can talk about the fact that there'll be hurricanes in the future, but you don't know exactly where they're going to go and where the path is going to go. And the second thing is, and the reason that we would writing this book is that there are people, decision makers often will think about these events as being so low that they'll be below their threshold level of concern. And there is that change, a sea change that has occurred really in the last 18 years. I'll use 2000 as a starting point here, where I think that firms are now paying attention to them in ways they never had before.
When you start your book, the prologue, talking about Morgan Stanley during 9/11, I don't know that we all understood what they had done in preparation for an event like this.
Well, I think that Morgan Stanley was an unusual company, and they certainly, that was highlighted by what happened after 9/11. Richard Rascorla, who was the CEO, had really invested in drills with the company and with preparation for a possible evacuation that was actually stimulated way back by the 1993 World Trade Center event that didn't really amount to very much in the way of, and it certainly didn't require evacuation. It was certainly caused a fair amount of damage. But he did this over a period of time. So when this event occurred, in 9/11. At that point, he was prepared and he got everyone out of the building in a way that would have been absolutely inconceivable had people not had that those drills in advance. So preparing for a disaster is really a theme that we highlight in the book, and that's the reason why we had this as part of the prologue.
But reading that just six staff members of Morgan Stanley were still inside when the tower finally imploded, and he was among them.
Right. Well, that's the tragedy of it all. I mean, that there are people who lost their lives as a result of this. A large number of lives were saved, but as you pointed out, he did not survive. And I think that raises always the question in terms of how do you do things in advance, but at the same time, what do you do at the time that a disaster occurs? And as you pointed out, people lost their lives because they took the steps to get everyone out. At the same time.
Yeah, well, he was a hero that I don't think many of us knew about.
No,
and then you talk
right.
about 7 years later, and in a very different context, the leadership of insurance giant AIG. Now, mm-hmm. this is a different kind of disaster, but it certainly did affect so many people. Explain what they did or did not do in anticipation of this.
Well, I think that the AIG situation is one that I think we face in many, many cases. There's a small division of a company or a division of a company that is operating pretty much on its own to deal with a situation, and then things implode as a result of that. And as a result, AIG faced that exact situation with respect to the financial crisis in 2008-2009, where they were really in a position where their activities were such that they really didn't anticipate essentially the very, very low probability event. And these were related, of course, to mortgage-backed securities. And as a result, they, of course, had to be rescued. And, of course, this is an example of a situation situation where when you do find yourself in a position where you say, things are not going to happen to me, and then they do, you may be caught off guard. Now, a real challenge in the financial crisis, and I do want to mention that since you're bringing it up, is that if firms were in a dilemma, because if they put a lot of money into taking protection and doing things, assuming that something might happen, they might actually have been hurt very badly if no other firms were doing that. And as a result, many of them said, well, I'm going to take my chances and hope nothing happens. And of course, something did. And it does raise a question, and we discuss this in the book, that there may be appropriate roles for regulation to play so you have a level playing field. Because if you don't have that, you have a competitive environment where everyone may be operating by saying, you know, this is a very low probability event. We're going to assume it's not going to happen. And if we take steps now, maybe we'd be hurt. Now, of course, there were companies, and Goldman being one of them, that actually did recognize some of this beforehand and came out in a much better position than a company like AIG did.
Let's talk about another disruption and another company that you point to. That's Walmart, the largest retailer in the world. And you came to appreciate that they actually took some precautions as it relates to Hurricane Katrina. Now, they get a lot of bad publicity, Walmart. But I do love, by the way, the quote that you use at the beginning of the book from their CEO. Make the best decision that you can with the information that's available to you at the time. Above all, do the right thing. And a lot of us wonder whether corporate titans are often doing the right thing for the right reasons. But Walmart, applying their technical understanding of global supply chains, explain what they did right in this case.
Well, I think that what Walmart did was that they recognized that they needed to have emergency operations centers and coordination. And so when they did this in many situations. In Katrina, they were particularly, I think, responsive, because they actually not only prepared for this by having appropriate tracking of their supply chain and the storm itself, knowing that they needed to have more than one supply chain to be able to prepare for this. But they also did something that I think is really important to highlight. They actually provided a great deal of disaster relief, food, blankets, clothing, to families who were hurt by Katrina. So they served a dual role. One is that they prepared for the disaster, and the second is that they really came to the rescue and felt that they had a responsibility to try to help out the people who were hurt by that. And we do talk about that in the book in terms of disaster relief. And one of our former student of ours, Luis Ballesteros, was working with Mike Youssef on just that issue in terms of how companies actually prepare not only for disasters but help if there is an event that occurs where they could be of some assistance.
What about all these massive recalls that we have seen of late in terms of faulty products? We know General Motors, we know that Takata, we know Volkswagen, Merck at times, Toyota and others. I mean, when you looked at those, how differently did they each respond to these crises? And what does it tell us about a company when we need to go back to them to say, fix this, or we are going to be imperiled by your lack of attention?
Well, I think that each company, of course, has dealt with these situations in their own way. But I think the one thing that happens when they find that their things are uncovered, that they have had some problems, is that they try to recognize that they've had that problem and try to deal with that. And I think that Toyota being one, certainly an example of a company that has done that. And I think this is, of course, one of the things that we talk about in the book. You try to avoid these low probability events by paying attention in advance and taking some steps to avoid them. And sometimes you can't do that. Now, I think the classic example, as you know, and it's still with us today, is Volkswagen, where they really weren't transparent and actually took steps to try to hide that. And we do mention that as part of the book in terms of public disclosure of where they came out. So I think, Larry, the point that we want to emphasize here, and when we were writing this, is that these events that have occurred, and you're pointing out a number of them that have occurred in recent years, and some of them we talk about in the book, and then there are others that we actually didn't do in the way of interviews, like Volkswagen. They really have raised the ante in a way. Companies are now have to be more concerned with them, and they are taking steps to say enterprise risk management and paying attention before the event is going to be very, very important.
Let me take another one where they say they were established in 18 whatever, but reestablished in 2018, trying to say, okay, we've wiped that slate clean and we're now a whole lot better for all of it. And I'm talking about Wells Fargo. And in your book, you quote Warren Buffett, it was a bad incentive system, he complained. The main problem is that they didn't act when they learned about it. And that really rankled a lot of us. I had a mortgage at one time with Wells Fargo, but thinking that they were setting up accounts for people and doing things that were really untoward, how did they respond?
Well, I think they're responding now in ways that is suggesting that they are not going to do this again. But originally and initially, there was a great deal of deception here, and I think it took some time before that they were found out. And when that happens, just what you said is the way a lot of people feel. Why didn't they come clean, and why were they doing this in the first place? Who is benefiting from this, and who is losing? And people like yourself, who had mortgages, who were feeling that they were really at risk, might actually say this was not the way actually to behave. So there is a real issue, and I think I want to come back to this issue of transparency, because we do highlight that as one of the checklists. You want to be transparent on the risks that you face and try to then deal with them, but let people know them in advance. And I think if you do that, you're going to be viewed in a very different way than you've described Wells Fargo being reviewed.
Should anyone take comfort that they are investing or they're involved with a company that is a public company, publicly traded, that they'll know more about them because they have more requirements to share information? Or is that a false sense of security that they're a public company?
I don't know whether it's a false sense of security or not. I think that I think each company, and there are private companies that are going to be very, very open with respect to what they're doing. We at the Wharton School have the Huntsman, and that's a large private chemical company, and I think they pride themselves on being open. I say that not to tout them as such, but to say that there's a private company that might be that way. So I think each company is going to do things in a different way, and I think that the examples that we've just been discussing are cases where they haven't been as open as they could be.
You point to McKinsey and Company, obviously so well respected as a management group, saying that there are these big bets, those major decisions that all firms have to make that are really, really important. How would you describe that? I mean, do you think most companies are spending a lot of time on managing the potential for catastrophic risk, these big bets?
No, I think the McKinsey quote is an important one, and I think the McKinsey really highlights that with the with what you just said. What we, I think our conclusion, let me just say, as a background to that, we interviewed 100 of the S&P, Standard & Poor's 500 large companies, and most of the people we interviewed were high in the organization, either CEOs or chief risk officers. We interviewed them with the idea that that there would be confidentiality, so we asked them about the most adverse risks they faced and how they were dealing with them today and how their decision process had changed over the years. And in the book, we do never specify any individual per se, or even what the company is. We just mention, you know, a large financial institution, a large chemical company, and mention who the individual is. And we do have quotes from these people. And I think that the general conclusion, Larry, that we come to through these interviews and then through a lot of work looking at reports that they've written, like 10K reports that come out every year, has been that this is now high on their agenda because of what has happened. And so they are paying a great deal more attention to trying to avoid these events in the future by looking at worst-case scenarios rather than saying the probability is below my concern, by thinking about near misses and things that could have happened but didn't happen but that they can learn something from, and actually by paying attention to other companies' misfortunes. So I think that there is a major sea change. And the other another group that is paying more attention to this are the board of directors, because this is high on their agenda. They recognize that they can provide advice, and they are willing to do so without necessarily getting involved in the details. But they are definitely putting this high on the agenda, partly because of what we're just talking about. There are headlines now, and there are things that we're hearing about, and they know that they're maybe partly held responsible for that, and so they feel they have to play a key role.
I forgot what the company was, but years ago when Warren Buffett, who usually just gets really wonderful attention, lavishing praise on him from all quarters, and he was a major shareholder in a company where he had to go in front of Congress and take responsibility and fall on his sword that he didn't quite know some of the practices that he was investing in. So when somebody like that has to really fall on their sword, I think that gets a lot of people's attention.
No question. And I think what the board of directors are now doing is they're putting this at a level where when they have their meetings, they want to know what's happening. They may not say that this should happen. They may say it would be very good for you to pay more attention to your risk appetite and your risk tolerance, but they don't know exactly how that will play out. But when you have people like Warren Buffett saying that, there are a lot of others who probably say a similar thing and are saying we better be prepared for this, and here's a role we do have to play, interacting very closely with the top management in the firm.
Absolutely. Mastering Catastrophic Risk, How Companies Are Coping with Disruption. Michael Useem and the co-author Howard Kunruther, who is with us here on America Trends. When we look at quarterly reports, we look at daily look-ins at CNBC, Fox Business, what does that do? Or are we too much attuned to the everyday and not the larger picture?
Well, that is the key question that we would want to raise, and we are raising in the book. We all have a tendency to be myopic. We focus on short-term horizons, and we pay attention in ways that actually often precludes us from thinking in the long term. And the point you just brought up on quarterly reports or annual reports or even annual bonuses may discourage firms from taking certain kinds of actions that could have long-term payoffs. And so we really try to highlight that in terms of strategies that could play a better role in dealing with this. And I'm happy to mention a couple if you'd like.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think one recommendation that we make, and that there's been a lot of experimental work that has been done, and our Wharton risk management decision process has been part of that process, is stretch the time horizon. And what I mean by that is as follows. If you can say to an individual or a person living in a flood-prone area, or you can say it to a manager in a firm, there's a 1 in 100 chance that something will occur next year. You will have a flood, a serious flood next year, or that there will be some kind of adverse event that will occur to firm. And you can look at the crises that we've gone through. When people hear that, there's a tendency for them to say, you know, it's not going to happen to me. We have so many other things on our agenda. I'm not going to pay attention to that. It's below my threshold level of concern or our firm's threshold level of concern. But if you instead said, think about the next 25 years and your firm, you would like it to be in existence, or your house, you'll be living in your house for 20 or 25 years. If you think about that, that same probability, if it's independent from year to year, there's a greater than 1 in 5 chance, or a greater than 1 in 4 chance, if it's a long enough time period, for this to happen. Interestingly enough, when you mention that, people then pay attention. And they say, well, you know, maybe I better think about what I can do for that. Well, those two probabilities are absolutely identical if the events are independent. But by telling 1 in 4, it's large enough to get on people's agenda. So that's one way that we would suggest that you might want to frame the decision in a manner that would actually be helpful to individuals to think about that and managers.
Just curious, when we think about all the things that have befallen the American economy
in the recent period. And some of it, of course, disasters like terrorist attacks, but few, but dramatic, clearly. Then, of course, the financial crisis. Then you've got companies that just didn't see the future. They didn't see the technology changing. And I guess Kodak is the best example, mm-hmm. saying we love our processes, we love our chemicals, but they didn't realize that people only really want to capture images and they don't care about all the breakthroughs they've made. So they were slow getting into digital. Of all those kinds of things, what do you think has affected the psyche? Because you've talked to over 100 business leaders in the process of this book, more so one to the other.
Well, I think that the one thing, we started our interviews by asking each of the people who were with us on the phone, and some we met personally in some meetings and a seminar we had. We said, what's the most adverse event that your firm has had? You may have been there, you may not have been there, and gave them the freedom to sort of talk about this. When we did, we asked the question like that, you got a number of different answers. Many times you would get, well, 9/11 or the financial crisis or Hurricane Katrina. We heard the Fukushima earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear meltdown as mentioned because of what it did to their firm. But you also might hear of kidnapping. Someone had one of their employees was kidnapped, and that caused a major problem for the firm because they had to deal with it in a way that was unexpected. And I mention these things because all those events, when you mention them, were not ones that these firms had taken protection against or had prepared for. And that was one of the reasons why they mentioned it. What you also get is that it has forced them to actually rethink the way they are going to manage their operations and also put on the table, as I mentioned earlier, the worst case scenarios, not thinking so much about the low probability of the worst case scenarios. And so we found when we talked to them about just the question you're asking about how they were perceiving the world, they really found themselves reacting in a way that enabled them to say, we are now changing. And the question I think we all can ask is, will that continue over time if nothing happens, or will you fall back to your old behavior? And our hope is that, and the reason for writing the book is that we have this checklist that will say, maybe you'd better pay attention at all times, rather than sort of saying, oh, just because this event happened, now we have to pay attention.
But, you know, many times the people who run these companies are really aggressive types. So that's how they got to where they are. And the whole idea of being defensive as opposed to offensive, where they say, I'm controlling the dynamic here, and I don't always want to be on my haunches. I want to be the one who's going forward, and I don't want to look at the worst case. I want to look at the best case. Do you find that mentality or that psychology having an impact on whether they really want to plan for some of these perhaps unforeseen events?
Well, it's a very, very interesting question in terms of how individuals play a role and how a firm plays a role. And I think that to some extent you're always going to find this aggressive behavior, particularly in a competitive world. And that's why I mentioned earlier the financial crisis of 2008-09. There was a tendency to behave much in that way by some of the firms that may have regretted it afterwards. I think one of the feelings that we had was that if you began to start thinking about this problem as not just at the level of the CEO or the very high person, but for all employees in the company, as many firms are doing, as they're moving into enterprise risk management, and that everyone has an opportunity to play a role, you have some chance to dampen that kind of behavior by having people at lower levels actually suggesting maybe these are things we'd better think about, and have a culture in the organization that we really want to prepare, rather than having someone say, oh, let's try and see if we can make as much money as we can in the next year.
Well, I love you've got 15 steps toward mastering catastrophic risk. Think long term, consider worst case scenarios, appreciate global interconnections, be aware of fighting the last war, conduct after action reviews. Lots of really practical information. The book, who would benefit most from reading this? I would imagine across all industries and people at mid management and higher levels.
Well, you know, we'll find that out as time tells. But what we obviously want the companies that we have spent time with, we hope they will pay attention now because they gave a lot of their time, and we hope that they would look at this as something that would be useful in their organization at all levels. We'd also hope that small businesses and others that are actually struggling because they have a lot of constraints might also pay attention to ways that they can change their behavior and address it. We did not interview small businesses, but we have spent a lot of time with them over the years, and I think that we'd like them to benefit. And then there's a whole other group out there, and there's the public. I mean, the general public. This book, we'd like to think, is written in a way that will be attractive to people who are thinking about their own lives and also how their lives tie in with their organizations. So we hope that that plays a role. And finally, and of course, this is something you know that I would say, we hope the academic community takes this seriously and that there's some interest in there actually seeing this as being helpful in terms of some courses that might actually fit into the area that
well, if they don't
about.
Listen to you guys at Wharton School, I mean, obviously, Wharton's gotten a lot of attention lately because of one of your alum, but also you're a great school. In closing, when we look at this, how companies are coping with disruption, would you define this as an incredibly disruptive era between climate change and uncertainties globally and just the pace of change technologically? Is this a very disruptive period?
This is a very disruptive period. I think, you know, we can say it from our own personal perspectives, but as you're saying, from the world, from the global perspective. Climate change being a wonderful example that you just used, because we need to pay attention to this now. We can't wait, and I think there's a tendency to sort of say it won't happen and to look at where we are right now. So I think it is a highly disruptive environment that we need to actually take some steps. And I would end by indicating that, you know, a phrase that we would like to use, and I'll use now, is expect the unexpected. Be unsurprised by surprise. And I think if we could operate on that level, I think life will become more interesting in many ways, but it also will force one to sort of say, maybe we better pay attention now rather than waiting until something serious happens.
Well, I hope our listeners to America Trends are paying strict attention to what you've been saying, Howard Kunreuther and Michael Useem, Mastering Catastrophic Risk, How Companies Are Coping with Disruption. Thank you very much, Howard. We really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure, and thank you for your very insightful questions.